extra on the song today.
Yeah.
Just having a little chaos here at the last minute. Jared, that belongs to Linda. She's going to need that.
Yeah.
We have a little transition show transition thing. We should never visit with the show host from the previous show because then...
And we become
tardy.
But, and we were on time.
Right.
Yeah.
We've been better. We've been better. The chaos has been kept to a minimum. Oh, but it's back. Alrighty. So let's see. Good news is I printed out what we're doing today, so I don't have to wait for my computer to show up. Oh, I do know my own name, if in fact I could say that properly. My name is Aaron Ryan, just
and
in case
Bill
you didn't
Cundiff,
know that.
And I can always say that.
And
I've said that for a long time.
I have too. That's why I never changed my name. I had to keep it the same. It was too confusing. I tried being someone else for 10 years. It was too hard. And the sponsor this hour is?
Yes. Sponsor this hour is Team Power. Team Power, local John Deere Kubota dealer. And right now you can get some great savings on Kubota and John Deere tractors down 3119 Twin View Boulevard. And go down and see them. Buy a tractor.
Are we talking about their website? Up and running?
Yeah, they got a brand new website, readingtractors.com. Readingtractors.com, and got a lot of deals on there. And if you don't see it on the website, give them a call and ask them, and they'll fix you up. If they don't have it in stock, they can get it for you.
And they're here open Saturdays now through the summer.
Yeah, Saturdays noon to 8 to noon. And
noon to 8, the other way around.
Yeah, noon to 8. Yeah, if you want to go that way, go back in time. But, yeah, Team Power, their phone number is 226-9226. Give them a call. Team Power.
There you have it.
There you are.
And you can find everything about our program, and you can also find our archives that are free of charge to listen to at wethepeopleradio.us. So we do a page for every guest we have on, for every show, and after the show, we link a commercial-free archive to that, and it hangs out there waiting for you. So I know we have lots of people who are busy on Sundays or don't like to be tied down or live outside the listening area, and so they plug in through the archives.
Yeah, we had how many people showed up last week during the week? It was a bunch.
Lots.
Yeah.
Several thousand people. We've got a lot of people listening around the world. So if you're in another part of the universe other than the United States, thanks for listening.
Yeah.
And thanks for telling a friend, because there isn't one country that only has one person listening now. I've been watching to make sure people have friends, so I don't know.
Did you mention sponsorship on the site?
What about it?
You can sponsor the show if you so desire.
If you're just a regular person,
yeah.
You can do that if you like. It's all right in there for you. So, without further screwing around here, our first guest is Richard Sander. And Richard, we're going to be chatting with him. This is a new topic for us, so thank goodness his publicist sent us a list of questions. He must have known we were knuckleheads. So he sent us a nice list of questions, so we'll follow along with that, because this is a topic we know nothing about, so we're all going to learn something. The article that I've posted of his is Moving Toward Integration, The Past and Future of Fair Housing. So let's see about our guest. He's a nationally acclaimed professor of law at UCLA School of Law. He's an economist and co-author of the new book that I just mentioned, Moving Toward Integration. He's a leading legal authority on matters of race, housing, and affirmative action, and a prominent social scientist on issues of inequality. So like I said, we're in uncharted waters. We know nothing about this. He's appeared on major radio and television programs nationwide. And then there's us. The New York Times, Wall Street Journal, The Economist, The Atlantic, quite a spread there. And others have all written about his work. His previous book, Mismatch, has shown the importance of studying the actual effects of affirmative action policies and reshape the national and legal debate on the issue.
Yeah. Now his bio can have at the top nationally acclaimed radio show, We the People. He's been on that one as well.
I'm sure he'll lead with that. Okay, he'll have more fun here, though. Richard, are you in there?
Yes, I am.
Hello, hi, Richard.
I'll make sure I do that. And, thank you for having me on.
Oh, you're more welcome.
Absolutely.
Thanks for being here.
Well, the good news is you'll have more time here than you will with the other people, and we won't give you the bum's rush at the end.
That's great.
So, shall we start with the questions, or are there things you'd like to tell us? Because we'll just follow along.
Well,
this is a cool topic.
Yeah, you know, there's race is a perennial important issue in America. And we've had a number of big racial controversies over the last few years. And what the book tries to do is dig deeper and say what is fundamentally driving racial inequality in America, and is there anything we can do about that? And the answer we come up with is that yes, housing segregation really underlies almost all the other issues.
Yeah, housing was supposed to solve all the problems, and you mentioned here that in a lot of cases it didn't. It didn't. It helped a lot of things, but there were some things that didn't cure.
Yeah, we've done a number of things that are right, but there has been very little examination of the big picture.
Which hardly ever happens in government programs.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, just to ground this discussion,
sure.
It's useful for me to describe something called the Index of Dissimilarity. And this is a measure sociologists use to say how segregated places are. So the index goes from 0, which represents complete integration, to 100, which is complete apartheid. And in the 1960s, before we passed fair housing laws, the average black-white dissimilarity index in American cities was 92. So it was pretty severe, and really something that no other ethnic group in America had experienced or has experienced since. And in 1968, we passed the Fair Housing Act. It was there had been a number of state and local fair housing laws, but they hadn't really accomplished very much. And the federal law prohibited discrimination based on race, national origin, religion, in the private market. And the Department of Justice pretty vigorously enforced it, not only during the Johnson administration, but actually even more so in the Nixon and Ford administrations. And discrimination fell pretty sharply. About two-thirds of the discrimination in the market in the 60s that we can measure had disappeared by 1980.
Wow, that's pretty
significant.
So that's
pretty dramatic.
Sure.
Yeah, so that really accomplished something. But falling discrimination, it turned out, did not eliminate segregation. If we look at how segregated things were by 1980, most of the big cities that have really large black populations had seen segregation fall down to maybe the high 80s. But there were about a dozen cities where there was pretty substantial drops in segregation down into the low 70s, sometimes even the high 60s. And so we looked at those more closely to try and understand what was driving the differences between the different types of places. And we came up with various mechanisms that actually seem to explain a lot, and I can go more into that later. But the other thing that we found was that where segregation fell, it continued to fall. It sort of was on a self-sustaining integration track. And black outcomes started improving in those areas. Almost anything that you look at, you see that in the cities that get the similarity down to low 70, African Americans start improving on health outcomes and test scores and employment rates, more two-parent families, and so on. So that seems to be the most powerful way of actually changing patterns of inequality.
And does it matter how dense the housing is? I mean, are we talking urban with big giant projects, or are we talking mostly single family, or is it just all of the above?
I'd say it's all the above. In other words, we don't see housing density as being a variable that explains whether integration happens.
Really?
Yeah. And, you know, these days, a lot of the integration that's happening is occurring through gentrification. Since the early 90s, many middle-class folks have been moving back into central cities. And that's been accelerated, I think, by the decline in urban crime rates. And that sort of integration seems to be as effective in reducing inequality as suburban integration.
Hmm. Yeah, because they're taking some of those, you know, big, like, factory buildings and turning them into these upscale lofts and that kind of stuff, I know, in some places. Does that actually help?
It does. You know, gentrification is more controversial than other types of integration, and there's a lot of fear in the fair housing community, probably the African-American community, about whether gentrification will just produce massive displacements. But so far, that has not generally been the pattern. There are some places where that's happened, parts of New York City, for example, parts of San Francisco. But usually, gentrification produces integration, and it opens up a lot of jobs, and it has a big impact on one of the most intractable problems, which is that segregation tends to concentrate black poverty, and when you have gentrification, that offsets that. That sort of reduces the concentration and opens up, creates a lot of new urban jobs. So, yeah. And if you think about it, you know, you can't have integration just go in one direction. If you just have African Americans and Hispanics move out of central cities into suburbs, then housing prices in the central city will become depressed. You know, there won't be enough demand for them.
Sure.
So gentrification is an important kind of complement to suburbanization.
Yeah, because it winds up looking like what, Detroit?
Yeah, you don't want things to become vacant and foreclosed.
Sure, it deteriorates to a point where it starts to look like a war zone.
Yeah.
Poor Detroit. I wonder if they'll ever pull it out. We have to take a really quick break, and we'll come right back. Our guest today is Richard Sander. We're talking about his book, Moving Toward Integration, and he is the co-author. So we'll be right back. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
So if you're dreaming about California, it don't matter at all where you
decide how it does. Well, you're never gonna go through twice. Stay tuned.
And we're back with our guest, Richard Sander. Hey, Richard, I was looking at one of the topics on here, and you kind of touched on it, but it was a pretty long list. It's a clip out of your book that says that your book argues that reducing residential segregation is the best way to reduce racial inequality, which you had said. African-American employment rates, earnings, test scores, family cohesion, and even longevity all improve sharply. That's kind of a... I mean, why did you guys... How'd you come up with all that?
Well, yeah, it's...
Because that's a really comprehensive list.
So there are now about a half dozen different solid studies that have found lower segregation causes a variety of better outcomes. There's been less research on exactly what the causal mechanism is. In other words, what's driving this? So we know the patterns there, but things are sufficiently interrelated that it's hard to disentangle exactly what, you know, how lower segregation does this. But there are three or four kind of plausible theories. One is that if you have more integration, then African Americans have access to better services. They're going to be in, usually they'll be in somewhat better funded schools. There'll be more responsive city governments, so on and so forth. A second is that they're closer to jobs. There's something called the spatial mismatch, and since the 1970s, in a lot of cities, jobs have tended to gravitate away from core areas where a lot of African Americans live.
And is it because this is inner city, yeah, or no?
Well, all these statistics that I talk about are looking at metropolitan areas as a whole. So, in other words, if an area like San Diego, which is pretty integrated, has an overall lower index of dissimilarity, that means the metropolitan San Diego area has that lower segregation level.
Okay.
So part of what's happening is that African Americans are closer to employment opportunities. But a pretty big factor seems to be just a change in cultural environment. That if you're living in a more integrated neighborhood, you have more role models who have gone to college, and you have classmates in school who have different study habits. And your family picks up on that, and that starts affecting decisions that are made. It starts affecting what time the kids go to bed, how much television they watch, how much reading parents do to their kids. So lots of different things are influenced by sort of your neighborhood milieu. And, you know, these seem to have a cumulatively powerful effect.
It's interesting because I would think it would be difficult to switch that around in an inner city kind of environment, because those patterns have been there for a long time.
Well, the effects we're talking about, like these mortality effects, this is after an area has been significantly integrated for a generation. And so there's that's time to really influence a lot of...
Sure, you can change a lot of habits. And
so do you find that when you start this integration process into a let's say a predominantly white neighborhood, when you bring in the integration, does it tend to bring in a lot of the negative attributes you find in one nationality? I mean, like, do when you bring
people
in...
Does it have the flip result?
An opposite effect of bringing a lot of the bad stuff with it, you know, the crime, the drugs, the gangs. Does that tend to happen as well?
Well, so there are two different patterns you see. And let me just use Chicago and San Diego as an example, because Chicago is a place that has made very little progress towards integration. There are some integrated spots, but its index is still in the low 80s, whereas San Diego has an index in the 50s. So after fair housing laws are passed, what happens in Chicago is blacks are much more mobile. They're moving into white neighborhoods in much larger numbers. But those movements are almost always into areas that are adjacent to existing black areas. So you have sort of a block-by-block expansion of predominantly black areas. And most of those areas go through racial transition. And where the migration is that large scale and sort of that pervasive, yes, it does. The neighborhood at the end of the day is doesn't resemble the white neighborhood that it was originally. It resembles the predominantly black areas.
Right, so the integration didn't work.
Exactly. So you have more mobility, you have more housing available to blacks, but you're not getting more integration. Whereas in San Diego, you have a much more dispersed pattern of migration. And one of the reasons for that is that San Diego in the 70s and 80s was taking off economically. It was attracting migrants, including African Americans, from around the country. And if you move to a metropolitan area after fair housing laws are passed, and you're black, then you're very likely anywhere in the country to move into what we call an outlying area, an area that's more than a couple miles from existing black concentrations. And those footholds are relatively small at first. So in San Diego, you have a lot of neighborhoods by 1980 that are, say, 5% African-American. But that's enough to change the way people sort of perceive the metropolitan area. Whites start perceiving the black areas as not being really black neighborhoods, but being neighborhoods that are becoming more integrated, and start moving into those areas. Blacks see a whole bunch of outlying areas as plausible areas for them to move. And so you get this incremental process of increasing integration. So you don't have any areas that are kind of going through sudden racial transition. You're seeing much more incremental change, but it's steady change, and it keeps building on itself decade after decade. And in those patterns, we don't see any of the sort of increases in crime or,
right,
or neighborhood deterioration.
Yeah, because I would think that in order for that to be effective and to have true integration, you've got to have the migration patterns going in both directions,
yeah,
or you're going to end up with, in the long run, it's going to look the same as it did in the beginning.
Yeah, ultimately, integration means all races see that neighborhood as a plausible place,
right,
a desirable place to live.
Interesting.
Right.
What about, I'm thinking of like the cultural I don't know, we called them ghettos when I was a kid, not because it was a bad place, it just, I don't know, that was the name of it. But like in the East, you have areas where all the Italians live, all the Irish live, where you have the Puerto Ricans live, and you have restaurants and grocery stores that cater to those
cultures.
Well,
it's like that in San Francisco today.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Well, you have, so how does that play in, or is this really a an African American and white kind of a thing that's the big dynamic?
Yeah, well, that's a really good question. We've always had segregated ethnic groups in America, because we've had this polyglot origin from all over the world.
Sure.
And it wasn't always like people did that to them. They lived there because they all spoke the same language. Again, like grocery stores, restaurants, those things. It was sort of their spot.
Their community, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, if you were an Italian moving to America in 1910, the logical place for you to go was Little Italy, because that's where you could find people who spoke Italian, who could show you the ropes, who could, give you housing. What's different is there are two things that make it different from what blacks experienced. One is that it never became as intense. The index of dissimilarity for Italian Americans or Jewish Americans or Chinese Americans never really was higher than say the low 70s, which is qualitatively quite different from the 90s, which the blacks experienced. Because if the index of dissimilarity is around 70, that means that you still have a lot of people outside your ethnic group in your neighborhood, and that helps fuel assimilation, which is the other big difference. I mean, Italian Americans, every decade that you can track during the 20th century, you see that folks who arrived in 1910, by 1920, they were more likely to speak English. By 1930, their children were intermarrying with other ethnic groups. They start moving out of the old neighborhoods. So there are levels of segregation which just kind of fall decade after decade. And eventually stabilize. Most ethnic groups in America stabilize around something in the 30s on my 0 to 100 scale. And that's great. An index in the 30s means that there are, you have identifiable neighborhoods, you have ethnic concentration with restaurants and so on, but there's no sort of dysfunction that goes along with that. There's no real social isolation. So for blacks, what was different is that from 1920 to 1970, they had these very, very high levels of segregation. And during most of that period, you had legal restrictions that made it very difficult for them to move into white neighborhoods.
And you also had a lot of incentives for, you had all this, the projects. I don't know what they call that now, but when I was a kid, that's what that was called. When we let's take a really quick break so we don't break up the answer on this, because this part is interesting, and for those of us who live in the rural parts of America, we don't deal with this much, and it's kind of a mystery. I mean, not everyone in the country, you've got a huge part of the country that doesn't live in a major metropolitan area, and we look at this like, why can't they get this?
Why can't the big cities?
So actually, this is good education for a large part of our country. We'll be right back with our guest, Richard Sander. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
I used to sleep at the foot of Old Glory and awake in the dawn's early light. But much to my surprise, when I opened my eyes, I was a victim of the Great Compromise.
Yeah, the Great Compromise. We thought that might lead us into our discussion on how the predominantly black communities wound up with the projects and all those things that
were talking about how other ethnic groups, the Chinese, the Italians, had their communities and still do to a certain extent, but were able to integrate into other communities.
They moved out.
They moved out into other communities where the black community, who were basically already here, stayed in their own communities and never really were able to integrate into the other communities. And I think a lot of people wonder why that was. And I think a lot of it was...
crappy policy trapped them there.
Is that it?
Tell us, Richard.
Is that it? Is it policy? Is it government policy that did that?
Well, you know, until the beginning of the 20th century, the black population was almost entirely rural, and almost entirely in the South. And that was was the legacy of slavery and the plantations and so
sure.
on. And the Great Migration started around World War I. And between 1915 and the late 60s, about 5 million African Americans moved from the rural South to cities, mostly in the North. And around 1919 and 1920, there was a wave of rioting in the North, all focused on black-white conflict. Whites were angry because blacks were a much more identifiable minority group. They were, you know, racism was common then. Blacks were seen as inferior by a lot of people. They were often brought in by northern manufacturers to break strikes by white workers. So there was a lot of racial animosity, and segregation, I think, was seen by both government and private groups as a solution to racial conflict. And it was a much easier sell to advance that in the 1920s. So you had mostly private policies, but with a lot of government cooperation that really created ghettos and surrounded many of those areas with restrictive covenants, which were private agreements where a whole neighborhood of white owners would agree not to sell to African Americans. And once that existed, and once you had these really intense levels of segregation, then there was a whole new level of fear based on, well, what happens if blacks start moving out of these areas? Then my neighborhood will be overwhelmed. As we saw, you know, eventually did happen when fair housing laws were passed in some cities.
When was the passage of the fair housing, like 50 years ago-ish?
68, yep.
Okay.
So between the 20s and the 60s, that was the era when a lot of the big housing projects were built. And if they, you know, those projects were pretty much racially designated when they were constructed. They were black housing projects and white housing projects. So you had many things that reinforced this pattern. And once you had that really strong pattern, then getting out of it was a big challenge. As we saw, when fair housing laws passed, some places like San Diego sort of had a combination of things that let those ghettos break down more or less spontaneously. But in most of our big cities, they just expanded.
Yeah, because you look at, Detroit, Chicago, you know, some of these cities have just, people have been trapped in these, I consider it trapped, maybe they don't feel trapped, but stuck there generation after generation, and the crime and all of that, it just seems like almost impossible to get out of there.
Yeah, I mean, all those cities now have large districts of very nice middle-class African-American housing. But even those neighborhoods have a higher presence of poverty than comparable white neighborhoods do, and usually have higher levels of crime and a variety of other problems. So the difficulty here is that it's hard to get out of what you could call a segregation equilibrium into an integration equilibrium. Places like San Diego and San Antonio and Seattle did it more or less spontaneously, but it probably won't happen spontaneously in most of our other big cities.
How long did it take them, and does it have anything to do with the amount of space they had to expand? I mean, does it have anything to do with how, you know what I mean? Like, some of our big cities have a massive number of people in a very small footprint. But a lot of times, like in California, our big cities have a little bit more room on the edges. Does it have anything to do with that?
Well, it probably helps. I mean, we know that economic growth in the 70s and 80s helped, partly because things were in flux, and you know, when a lot of other changes are going on, it's easier for a change like this to happen. But interestingly, a lot of the southern cities which weren't necessarily any bigger than the northern cities, did have more desegregation in the 70s and 80s and have continued to have somewhat more
because they had this
reverse migration. You had blacks moved in vast numbers from the south to the north in the first half of the 20th century, and then starting around 1970, a lot of urban blacks moved back to the urban south. And when they made those moves, they usually moved to more integrated areas.
Well, that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, so a place like Atlanta or Nashville has substantially more integration than Chicago or Detroit or New York. They're still not, you know, they haven't quite hit that critical mass where everything starts really substantially desegregating, but they're a lot closer.
So what do you see policy-wise now? I mean, where are we and where are we headed when you start looking at what we do? Is it mostly national policy or is it things that are statewide?
Well, I'd say at all levels of government. The things that we're doing these days, I think, are not aren't what we need to do. In other words, there's still a lot of focus on housing laws, which I think is great. I mean, discrimination is much, much lower than it was in the 60s, probably a tenth or less of what it was. But, you know, it's still certainly important to fight it where it shows up. There's a lot of a focus on where subsidized housing should be built and located. And that, I think, is kind of a counterproductive investment of energy, because if you have a proposal to put, say, 100 units of subsidized housing into a suburb, that becomes a real flashpoint of controversy. It's sort of the way to maximize political opposition to integration. And I think there are a lot of other strategies we could do that are much more market friendly and based on choice, and yet probably reaching many more people.
What would be an option to that?
So an example are what we call mobility centers. The one part of Chicago that's quite integrated is in a western suburb called Oak Park, which is, it's very close to some very segregated neighborhoods, but it's managed to be extremely integrated because it has a city service that essentially encourages people to come in and get help with planning a move. And the center collects information on lots of housing opportunities, works with, you know, housing agents and so on, and essentially smooths the path for people to consider a wider range of neighborhoods than they might on their own.
Oh, okay.
And fosters pro-integrated moves, encourages, helps whites identify integrated neighborhoods where they'll feel comfortable and find good housing, encourages blacks to move into predominantly white neighborhoods. And through that, Oak Park has just become steadily more integrated. And now it probably doesn't even need that center. It's kind of created its own little integrated metropolis.
People have kind of figured out how to do that. So it isn't a place where people are housed. It's a place where people get help to find housing elsewhere.
Right.
See, because it's true, we see that here. You know, every now and then there is a push to put in low-income housing, and, you know, the people who own homes near there are like, oh, here we go. And they do typically kind of go downhill.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the findings on that differ, and it probably depends on how it's done and so on. But
absolutely.
In any case, it's very expensive per unit, and it sort of makes it sort of highlights all the disadvantages of integration instead of the advantages. So another strategy is to try to insulate some of the housing in the neighborhoods that are going through gentrification. So a lot of times, developers will be interested in investing in new housing in urban cores, as we talked about before. And that often becomes a flashpoint of opposition. You know, just as a white suburb might oppose a public housing development, so an inner-city neighborhood might oppose a developer who wants to build luxury condos. It's sort of the mirror image.
Right, because you do hear about that a lot.
Yeah, and if we can shelter some of the housing in those neighborhoods from that can change people's attitudes about gentrification. Because fundamentally, moving affluent people into cities is going to be good for the city. It's going to be good for the neighborhoods. What people are concerned about is that their housing is going to become unaffordable, and they won't be there to enjoy those benefits. So if you have a trust fund that essentially buys some of these units, puts a restriction on how quickly the rent in that building can go up, and then resell it into the private market, you've got a mechanism for diffusing that neighborhood hostility and making sure that the gentrified neighborhood will still be an integrated one.
No, that makes sense. Yeah, because it goes both ways, you know. There goes the neighborhood, right? Yep. I mean, we have affordable housing, and now we're not going to because all the fancy people showed up.
Well, I think that's the big concern with people is you take a predominantly middle-class neighborhood and move affordable housing in, you're basically moving people in that have a lower social status or lower income level and don't have the same lifestyle as the people that live there currently.
If you do it in big blocks like that.
Yeah, and so
I like your mobility center?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's the way to do it, because then people can go where they want, and you're not hurting people
right.
like cattle, basically.
Yeah.
Which is never a good way to, here, let me help you. get on the bus and we'll take you there. Got to take a really quick break. Our guest today is Richard Sander. We're discussing his book, Moving Toward Integration, The Past and Future of Fair Housing. You can find us online at wethepeopleradio.us. Be right back.
Where do we go from here?
Practicing our night moves, trying to lose the all like Southern Michigan summertime.
I don't know what you think about pink houses, Richard, but, you know, that could be like your theme song for the book.
It's always good to have a theme song.
Yeah, a little pink or whatever color you like houses, you know. You're one of the points here that they had sent us this was kind of an interesting deal, and it's something that, you know, nobody talks about because it's kind of dangerous water to swim in. But it says here, moving toward integration notes that liberals tend to emphasize discrimination and racism as explanations for continued segregation, while conservatives usually accentuate the role of personal preference and self-segregation while making the case against government social engineering. That's so loaded, but I know you can unravel that for us, and we'll just shut
That's
up and let
crux
you talk.
Of the problem right there.
Sure.
Well, yeah, I mean, we have a very divisive conversation about race in America.
Yes.
You know, part of the problem is that we have these competing worldviews that don't seem to have any overlap at all. And the rhetoric that's used on the left to try to draw attention to racial problems like police shootings and segregation itself really does tend to use this very strong language. And I think when you emphasize racism, it seems to me that you're sort of doing the most counterproductive thing you can do, because on the one hand you're making whites feel very defensive. And on the other hand, your message to blacks is sort of like, well, you know, whites are bad, so why would you want to live around them?
That's true. I didn't even think of that.
Yeah, so it's like, you know, if you try to come up with a really bad strategy, it would seem to me it would be something like that. And conversely, I think it's also fair for liberals to say that arguing that any effort to increase integration is social engineering is a little bit unfair, because there was a lot of social engineering that was increasing segregation during most of the 20th century. So in places that are stuck, where segregation is just not declining in a way that you know that we see in other metropolitan areas, it makes sense to see a role for government in trying to nudge things along. So I think there's a middle ground that that if articulated could attract support across the political spectrum. Because at the end of the day, you know, people, I don't think the right feels that racial inequality is healthy for America in the long term. And I think the left focuses a lot on manifestations of inequality, but has sort of lost its focus on what are fundamental mechanisms, what are fundamental things we could do to reduce inequality.
And how blaming people for things they either didn't cause or can't control isn't really helpful.
Yeah, you know, and it may produce some short-term reforms, but what we really need is a kind of a grand strategy.
I think, I don't know if we touched on this much, but people of all races need opportunity to improve their lives, and I think with the black community, I don't think if given the choice they want to live in low income housing, they want to move up in the world, but you have to be able to give them some opportunity to make more money, to be more successful, to improve their standard of living. And if we don't, you know, do something about giving them that opportunity to improve their own situation,
they can't move out.
They can't move out. I mean, you can put them in any kind of house you want, but if they can't afford to live there, it's going to revert back to what they came from. So don't you feel that you know, employment and education, I think, are two things that are probably big considerations into improving this integration?
Yeah, whether you have options or whether you don't.
Right, exactly.
It really is important, but it's also I want to emphasize something that's often overlooked, which is that we have Although black median income nationally is only about 60% of white median income, there is a lot of overlap between black and white incomes. And there is a lot of heterogeneity in our neighborhoods already in terms of how expensive housing is. You know, we all live in neighborhoods that have more expensive housing, frequently apartments. And there's enough range there that when you measure it, the economic component of segregation only explains about a quarter of what's there.
No kidding.
So what that means is that we can actually make a lot of progress in any metropolitan area towards integration without changing anybody's income. We want those changes to happen as reform proceeds, but we don't need to start by making big income transfers. We can start by just reducing segregation levels down, you know, into that those levels, low 70s and 60s that I talked about before. And then you start these other mechanisms that that further reduce inequality.
So if you could roll into a place, which place did you say was, you know, really hovering at the bottom, like Chicago?
Yeah, Chicago, St. Louis, New York, Milwaukee, all those places are still in the 80s on our 0 to 100 scale.
So if you could roll in to any one of or all of those from a policy standpoint, what would you, you know, what would your changes look like? Like, where would you start? What's the most important thing to either get rid of or add?
Well, it's very important to have a metropolitan level approach because you're really talking about metropolitan integration. You can't do this on a neighborhood by neighborhood level. So you've got to have some sort of cooperative enterprise among the various regional governments. And the second thing is that you articulate this as a goal. You sort of say, you know, we have identified our high level of segregation as a problem, and we're not going to force anyone to move, but we're going to try to see if we can get metropolitan segregation levels down through a variety of nudges and modest programs. So resetting public expectations about what's going on, I think, is a really important thing.
And would you do this with policy, like government policy or private industry? Like, I understand there's a role for private industry, but could this be done just through the private sector, or does it require the government to be? I realize you're going to have to use the government if you're, housing and different things, but how do you see that breakout?
Well, in principle, you could do it all privately, and I think, in terms of a realistic political path to doing this, what might really get things rolling is if a couple of major foundations started initiatives like this in a couple of substantial metropolitan areas. We cost out what it would cost to do in the Buffalo metropolitan area, for example. And it's well within the means of many foundations. It's much less expensive than a lot of existing government programs. But yes, at some point, you want this to become part of government policy. We have a lot of fair housing policies now, and you want those to sort of move towards what we would call a next-generation policy that really focuses on integration.
Instead of just preventing discrimination.
Exactly.
Well, that makes sense. What's the one thing you'd get rid of that's keeping things the way they are that you see?
You want to try to intervene in cycles where resegregation is happening. So the neighborhoods that you're most interested in trying to address are those where racial transition is occurring. And those are the areas where you'd want to sort of reach out first in terms of mobility centers and so on.
And is a mobility center just like an office with people who can, I mean, is
help that kind of direct where?
Yeah, is it like an employment center
where they want to be?
They work on housing?
Yeah, they're going to have expertise in the housing market. They're going to be finding listings. They're going to know contacts that can help smooth the path for a family moving to a neighborhood. They could also, if they were cooperating with local government agencies, they could also have access to housing programs where, you know, we have vouchers that are provided for people who meet eligibility and so on. They could coordinate all that.
So if you were going to, if you lived in a major metropolitan area and you were listening to this and you thought, you know, I really think we should do that, who would you reach out to help you set up a mobility center that works well?
Well, reach out to me. I'm at UCLA, and
well, there you go.
Pretty easy to find on the web. We're putting together a national council of folks who have who've either done research or advocacy in this area, and we're in conversation with possible funders. So the hope is, I mean, the book just came out quite recently, but the hope is over the next year or so we'll actually start building some of the infrastructure for this.
Nice.
Great.
Well, thank you so much. we filled up that hour, and we probably could have gone for a second one. We hope you'll keep us posted on how this is working out for you. Our guest is Richard Sander. His book is Moving Toward Integration, and you can find all that information at wethepeopleradio.us. Thanks, Richard.
Good talking to you both.
Yeah, thank you.
Have a great day. For the second hour. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
We're so much more organized the second hour.
Yeah. We're on our game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this hour is brought to you by Team Power.
Team Power. There you go. Oh, got some volume.
Yeah. Team Power is our local John Deere Kubota tractor dealer. If you want a great buy on a tractor, go by and see him at 3119 Twin View Boulevard. Or give them a call at 226-9226. They got some great deals right now.
Or on the web with an amazing web address.
There you go.
That Redding. I made like 20 years ago.
Yeah.
That they're now using.
That's right. ReddingTractors.com. It's so simple. Get on that website and see what they got going on. Team Power.
It's funny how life repeats itself.
Yeah.
Made that address for a totally different business in another life.
Yeah.
Dun, da, 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 da. Yeah. All right, you can find all of our good stuff at wethepeopleradio.us. We have archives set there for, I don't know, 8-9 years, something. It goes way back. First hour today, we were talking about housing, the fair housing thing in urban areas and metropolitan areas.
Integration,
We are going to shift gears hard now, and we're going to go to rural things, which is typically what we talk about. We were way out of our depth last time. This time, we're kind of working in our wheelhouse a bit, but with a guest we don't know very well, so we're going to let him do most of the talk, and we have Ammon Bundy with us this afternoon, and I hope I'm saying that properly. I kind of forgot to check that ahead of time, and I hear your name pronounced, well, the Bundy part people get correct, but your first name, people get that wrong all the time.
Yeah, it's Ammon. You said it right.
Nah.
Ammon Bundy.
Right. Okay, that's what I was guessing. And, you know, it's really funny. I was searching the web. Obviously, you're not hard to find on the web. But I was searching the web looking for, like, a good bio for you. And I got to tell you, it's all in your interpretation. You could be a real nice guy who lives in a rural area, or you could be a complete terrorist. So I decided not to do a bio for you. I thought you could tell us what you wanted us to know. I figured it'd be more accurate that way.
Yeah, well, I don't even know if it'd be accurate for me. But
well, let's go the skewed view that's probably true, because, you know, we all know Wikipedia can be influenced by anyone who can type. And your Wikipedia page, it's all over the place. You can tell it's had a lot of help from other people.
A lot of input.
Yeah, I've thought about trying to get in there and straighten that out, but I don't know what good it'd do.
Yeah, it'd probably just shift right back. But, yeah, it is pretty, because they say you're an American car fleet manager. And I was like, huh? Who led the 2016 occupation of the National Wildlife Refuge. He's the son of rancher Cliven Bundy. At least I got that right. They at least figured out who your dad is. Who was the central figure of the 2014 Bundy standoff regarding unpaid grazing fees on federally owned public land. That's your bio.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well,
that's a nice start.
But maybe I could add a little bit to that.
Yeah, we figured you could probably do better than that.
Yeah, I live in Idaho. I am the third son of Cliven Bundy. My family's been ranching in southern Nevada for 142 years. 1877, my family went in there and just, you know, began to establish that area and graze on it. They were just, it's a rough old desert, and they went in there and started grazing and started developing some farms, and anyway, just have been there ever since.
And this is land that was managed by BLM, is that correct?
Well, I mean, we were there long before. The BLM was established in 1946.
Right.
My family was there a long time before the BLM was there.
And then they came in. And
just to make it, just to you know, tidy up a point for the public, actually, it's not federal land. I really hope people can learn to strike that from their vocabulary. It is public land.
That's right.
I like you already.
Yeah, it just drives me nuts.
It is not.
It's federal
not,
land,
it's
and they own it. And I'm like, no, it's public, and you own it. Stop it.
Well, and that's really the whole battle right there, all said in one sentence. You hit it on the head, and it's public land with private rights that are tied to it. And those private rights have been established by, you know, I mean, these are vested property rights that are deeded with, you know, at least my family's rights are deeded with the state of Nevada. And, you know, they're as real property as your home or your car or anything else that you've bought. And the federal government came in, you know, 70 years after my family had been there, and then they began to establish some of these, you know, different policies and regulations, and slowly converted our right, or tried to convert our right, over to a privilege and saying, hey, we own the land now, and therefore, because we own the land, none of these existing rights that are up on the land are yours. But the law, even the federal law, all the, you know, the acts, all those acts are, say, completely contrary. They say any activity or any management that the federal government does upon the land has to recognize and support the existing rights. And that's what they forgot, and that's what this battle's over.
Right, right. They came in and wanted to apply brand new rules that were not voted on, they were their own rules, and you can't do that.
Well, the government, through federal employees, and obviously, we just say it up front, not all, but many of our people who work for agencies consider that land theirs. We had a forest supervisor here in our local national forest who used to refer to the national forest as her forest. And she was very upfront in saying in public meetings that her goal was to spend her entire budget on keep out signs because she wanted her forest to be quiet. She didn't want any, you know, all this nasty hiking and horses and annoying people out there messing up her forest.
Yeah.
It's like, well,
again, excuse
me. Have we lost our way?
Yeah.
So back to public land and the use thereof. Okay, so how'd you get wound up with the Hammonds up there? Because that's like the latest. Well, all right, sorry, I'm all over the place. Because we have two things we want to make sure we talk about today. Your case involving your family and your dad and all that was dismissed. So maybe we should tidy up that loose end first. Is that okay? Since that's like the happy news. And
uh-oh.
Did we lose him?
Are you in there, Ammon? Hello?
Ammon has gone to the cone.
Can you hear me?
Oh, there we go.
There you go.
He went to the cone of silence.
We well, so I think I heard you.
Okay.
I don't know. So my whole entire... So we... Let's back up a little bit. In 2014, the federal government claiming that the land was theirs, and of course we were not willing to basically allow them to take that claim because my family had been there for at that time 138 years, and so they tried to take it by force. They brought in. It was a full military-type operation. They acknowledge it now that it was a military-type operation. It was controlled by, you know, military command systems. And
which I think is the first time people realize that BLM has their own armed military, basically, which was kind of a surprise to a lot of folks, is why does somebody like BLM have to have full armed support? But they did.
Yeah, they don't, and that's another illegal, you know, unconstitutional act in which they are, you know, willing to impose on the people and enforce it. They don't have law enforcement,
no,
or policing powers. That power is reserved away from them. And but they are still willing to go ahead and, you know, really, if you can have a gun and you can somehow legitimize, you know, a force, you become very powerful and impactful mm-hmm. upon people.
Well, especially
and
when you roll in as the federal government.
Yeah, if you can, you know, have your cars and vehicles with the, you know, federal government's logos on. And anyway, it ended up being they had 213 armed personnel.
Holy crap.
And they put snipers on the hill and surveillance equipment and basically, you know, put our ranch under siege. They threatened that if we resisted in them destroying and taking our ranch in any way, that they would, that this would be another Waco or Ruby Ridge. That was their words. In fact, the kind of liaison, if you will, told us that that if we resisted, they would kill us. And
that's great negotiation. Well,
and that took years to come out eventually, right?
What's that?
I mean, when you guys claimed that that's what they said, they basically called you a liar all the way till pretty much last year, right?
Well, yeah, the U.S. prosecutors, so, again, it's a long story, but we basically just began to expose all of these things, you know, showing pictures of the snipers on the hill and all the equipment, and they began to actually physically abuse us and throw, you know, like they threw my Aunt Margaret, she was 57 years old, they literally from the behind just come back, body slammed her on the asphalt. They tased me, you know, sick dogs on us, did a bunch of stuff. We began to expose that, and next thing you know, we got, you know, thousands of people coming to the ranch.
So all and that happened before everybody showed up?
Yes.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize that. See, so much of this, obviously, and you know, we've got to rely on what we hear, so the story was... obviously, seeds of truth, but comes out all screwed up. We've got to take a really quick break, and then we're going to come right back. Our guest is Ammon Bundy, and we're chatting about the 2014 standoff, and then we'll move into the Oregon thing, if possibly we can fit all that into 1 hour. You can find us at WeThePeopleRadio.us.
And just as it's one thing you should always find, you got to saddle up your boys, you've got to draw a hard line.
When the gun smoke settles, we'll sing a victory tune.
We'll raise up our glasses against evil forces, singing whiskey for my men, beer for my horses.
I hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me.
Well, there we go. That auspicious intro. we tried to pick good music for you. There were a lot of choices. Okay, so...
So getting back to our
the 2014
case,
standoff, yeah. and when you try to do the elevator speech on this, it's probably kind of hard.
It is, because there was so much that happened. You know, basically what happened, you know, kind of where we left off is... a lot of people, you know, several thousand people came and basically gave their support to our family.
And they had been after you guys for how long before the people showed up to help?
Oh, well, I mean, they've been after my dad for 20 plus years. But
wow.
when they had surrounded the ranch before the people came, you know, it was less than a week, just to actually to begin to, it was, I don't know, about 4 or 5 days that we were under that, those circumstances, those really intense circumstances. And then we started, again, getting the truth out, and people started responding to it. And the prosecutors later, you know, when they drafted up an indictment that put us in prison for 2 years on false charges, they basically said that we had made all that up, that there was no snipers, that there was no, you know, plan to basically destroy my family, that they even said, you know, that they made all kinds of different things up, and then, but most of it was that we incited the people over cyberspace, which was their terminology.
Oh, really?
And, anyway, but basically what we were able to prove very clearly and very easily, actually, in court, was that everything that they said was a lie. And once the judge saw this and saw how detrimental it was going to be to the federal government because of, you know, how they handled everything and what they did to us and then putting us in prison for 2 years on false charges, she dismissed the case. And we finally got to go home. But it was quite a battle.
That's just totally incredible. You know? Yeah, that they can lie and get away with it for 2 years. I mean, keeping you in jail for 2 years under false charges.
And you weren't like in county jail. You were in, like, big jail, right?
Yeah, we were in the worst circumstances you could, you know, be. We were in, you know, maximum security federal detention centers. And, you know, I never got to lay eyes on my family for almost 2 years, never got to hold them, you know, couldn't, you know, there was just, I mean, I could go on and on. I spent 2017, I spent almost half the year in solitary confinement.
And this was all because they thought you were going to, I mean, we have people who are really hardcore criminals that are watching TV and hanging out in the visitor's room.
Yeah, we were treated. I mean, I associated me in the prisons. I saw, and we were treated worse than any of those individuals. And those individuals who admit that they're criminals and admit that they should be in prison couldn't believe how unjustly we were being treated.
The prisoners felt sorry for you. Yeah, that's pretty bad.
Yeah. I mean, it was crazy. Mm. But we made it, and so that's kind of the. You know, and basically what happened, to kind of sum up 2014, what happened is at the time when people, you know, several, you know, thousand people showed up and it was become a national, you know, news story and international even, the, you know, Bureau of Land Management, and there was other agencies involved, they decided that This was a, you know, going to be a nightmare for them, and basically enough pressure was put on them that they actually abandoned their whole mission and left the area within just a few hours.
Well, I think you know, that was one of the first times, at least that I can remember, where the citizens actually stood up against the federal government. And they backed down, all the way. You're right. They pulled up stakes and they left.
It was going nowhere good.
Well, I think looking at it from this standpoint now, they knew they were wrong. They knew they overreached, and they could not find a compromise. It was just get the hell out of there before this turns into a bloodbath. And they knew they were wrong.
Yeah, there's absolutely. They knew they were wrong. And the people were just going to continue to assemble, and and, you know, if they weren't going to be able to do it peacefully, they were going to drive them out of there. I mean, that's just the reality, because, you know, I don't know if people are fed up with it or they just saw this situation as just so unjust.
I think
and
both.
So anyway, either way, they made the right decision finally, and they left, and. We went into their corrals and we got, you know, the almost 400 head of our cattle back and put them back on the range.
And then how long before they came after you and put you in prison?
2 years.
Okay.
It was two years later. But, you know, I forced the issue on them. I won't deny that through the Hammond situation. And, you know, what happened was, I have to admit, I was pretty naive to really the level that our government was at, the federal government was at. I mean, I had no idea that they would take it and do what they did. And, you know, when I saw it from the you know, inside, I guess, I began to really realize, you know, the situation that rural America is in and how it basically, what they were willing to enforce, and it was a combination between those that are pushing this, you know, socialist agenda and the extreme environmentalists. And I began to, you know, be able to, you know, understand these things better. And then right about, you know, that time, I find out about the Hammond family. And it was another ranching family in eastern Oregon. Been there for, you know, many, many decades. Have private rights to graze and have vested property rights on public land, just like we were talking about, which is a right. And then also had water rights, and they had private property on the Steen Mountain, and they were doing a prescribed burn, and like many prescribed burns, it jumped over the prescription area, and which was it burned on their, again, on their range right, though it burned about a little over 100 acres, which is nothing in that area. I mean, people right. might think, oh, 100 acres, oh my goodness, but I mean, we're talking about hundreds of thousands, even millions of acres. And it was no big deal. They put it out themselves, didn't cost the people nothing. It was really not, really wasn't even, I mean, it was no big deal.
And it's not the kind of fire that burned down, I mean.
It wasn't a big timber fire.
No,
it was,
we're talking
it was
grass.
And, grassland.
Yeah. No, no.
Which is actually good for it.
The federal judge that ended up being on the case, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the BLM actually had to acknowledge in their own studies that the prescribed burn actually improved the land.
Sure.
And
they do prescribed burns.
What's that?
They do prescribed burns. I mean, we live in a really dry area in Northern California, and they do a lot of prescribed burns here. And I can think of several instances, one in particular, where BLM was doing a prescribed burn and nearly burned down a town. So,
well, yeah, that actually happens all the time, but they don't get prosecuted.
Right,
for
right.
It.
Right.
That's the difference.
That's the inequality that we're facing here. And really what it come down to it is it came down to that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services wanted the Hammond Ranch. They had tried to purchase it. They had tried multiple things to get, you know, the Hammonds out of that ranch. And over 100 ranches in that area had either been condemned or through some type of method or even purchased. But in one way or the other, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services had got their hands on those ranches, and the Hammonds were one of the ones left, one of the last ones left, and they wanted that ranch. And, you know, basically used this prescribed burn going over the prescribed, you know, area. They used it as a way to prosecute them.
Sure. And I'm sure that became a leverage tool. We have to take a really quick break, but when we come back, I want you to tell people why they wanted their ranch or why you think they wanted their ranch. Because to people who don't live in rural areas, I'm sure it's like, why would they do that? That sounds weird.
Yeah, and I also want to talk about what they prosecuted them for, because that was utterly ridiculous.
Yeah, we have a long list. Okay, we didn't have anything to ask you, but now we got tons of questions. You're listening to We the People. Our guest is Ammon Bundy. We'll be right back. We the People Radio.us.
Yeah. so now we're back.
So now that we've established that, they will be watching you. All right, continue on. Why'd they want the Hammond's Ranch?
Well, again, it kind of comes back to this combination of individuals that have infiltrated the federal government. And I'm not trying to talk a conspiracy here. It's just, I mean, it's factual. We have, you know, the environmental group, the extreme environmentalists, who take it as their, you know, religious duty, or you might want to say a moral duty to them, I guess, to protect, you know, the land and the animals from all of us wicked people.
Right.
And so, and you know, they, and the Steen Mountains became kind of one of their, I don't know, covenanted areas, and that area. And then, of course, you've got the refuge, who, which has grown to almost 200,000 acres. All of it was private ranches at one time. And they're expanding, you know, and when they can expand and they can get more employees and more of these, you know, more of their own people, kind of, and
yep.
And they can employ them and give them great jobs. And I mean, it's a whole gig, you know. It almost becomes like a, you know, a literally, you know, almost like a little kingdom for them.
It's and a, they've got I, all the I believe we should want. We should probably use the right term. It's a fiefdom, because we would be the serfs.
Exactly.
Well, yeah, I don't know your audience, so but that's exactly what the situation we're under. We've seen this before, and I wanted to use that terminology, but I didn't know if I was talking to an audience who would understand me when I say that.
Well,
but
they can look that up.
Basically,
we want to educate.
That's what we have. That's what the Hammonds were facing, and they were wanting to expand. And, you know, the Hammonds were resisting. And really what it come down to is the Hammonds wouldn't comply to what they wanted them to do. There were certain things, for example, like in order for the Hammonds to go from one range to another, they had to go through the refuge, you know, the wildlife.
To move their cattle from one.
Exactly. Which they had done for 100-plus years, ever since those ranches. And they actually had a right-of-way. It was a legal established right of way, and the refuge said no. Well, that just caused a whole bunch of trouble. And so, what did the Hammonds do? They had to do it. They drove their cattle through the refuge on the road, just like they've done every year. Well, then the federal government, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, you know, they try to say that they did something illegal, and all of these are kind of battles. Another issue that they had was the Hammonds owned some waters up on the Steen Mountains and around. They were legally owned by them. The waters are deeded with the state of Oregon. The refuge tried to take those waters. And at one point, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service actually began fencing off these waters that belonged to the Hammonds. And Dwight Hammond, who was the father, actually tried to stop them physically, you know, because they're physically building a fence around their waters. And when he did that, they called the sheriff, and obviously he was a very uneducated sheriff, and he arrested Dwight for impeding a federal officer's duties.
Oh, geez.
So here, literally, Dwight has vested water rights. And they had already been in litigation with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and the state had ruled that those waters belonged to the Hammonds. And so now you got the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service fencing them off. Dwight tries to stop them, and then the county sheriff arrests him, and they charge him with two counts with of resisting the federal or impeding federal officers' duties. And this is the kind of stuff that's been going on, you know. And meanwhile, you know, they're trying to make an offer to the Hammonds of trying to, you know, buy their ranch. And it came
which
pretty
is,
obvious.
Which is just a coercion. I mean, we'll stop making your life hell if you just give us your property.
Exactly. And that's what happened to a lot of the other ranchers, most of the other ranchers. Their life became such... I mean, they were put in such duress that they just finally just gave up. And the Hammonds weren't willing to give up. That's,
Well, when they had the fire jump the line there, which, as you said, it really did no damage, didn't they at that point charge them with domestic terrorism?
Yeah, so what happened is there's a, after the Oklahoma City bombing, Congress passed an act called the Anti-Terrorism Death Penalty Act of 1996. And in that act, there's some statutes in there or some charges in there that are called terrorist arsonism, or arsonal terrorist. And I'm sorry, I haven't looked at the terminology.
That's right.
Basically, it's act of terrorism through arson. And they use that act and those charges to prosecute the Hammond.
Unbelievable.
When all they did was burn the grass like they've done every year for the last, you know, I mean, we know the Native Americans were burning the grass. You have to burn the grass in that area. You either have to graze it, you know, chop it somehow, or burn it. You know, it's just like your lawn. I mean, if you let it grow up year after year after year, you know, or even month after month, you end up with a bunch of dry and dead grass that's going to catch on fire. And until you cut it, the new grass can't grow up. And so there is no nutritional value or very little nutritional value for the cattle. So, I mean, you have to burn the grass. That's what everybody does.
Right. And it's no nutritional value, we might add, for deer, for elk, for whatever animals that live in those areas. And for people who don't live in rural areas, there aren't lines on the ground when it's your property and like it crosses over into public land or whatever, that there aren't clear marks. So it isn't like anybody would care.
Well, no, just to support that a little bit, didn't the Forest Service just come out with a report that said that they're going to change their policy now and allow grazing to manage the grasslands where in the past they were prohibiting grazing? So you're right.
They discovered it was actually good for the area.
Yeah, they actually figured that out. Well, it had been done that way for, like you say, hundreds of years, and now they just figured it out.
The other thing that's good now is flood irrigating, by the way. Newsflash, flood irrigating is actually good for the aquifers and the groundwater tables. Huh.
Yeah.
Who could have seen that coming?
Well, that it just kind of goes to exactly what this is all about. When you unwind it all, when you get a close look and you actually get the facts, you realize it has nothing to do with the land, the animals, you know, as far as benefiting them. Man on the land has always benefited the animals more than this policy of, this no use policy. And we've tried to, as a agricultural community, rural community, trying to defend our rights on these lands. We've proven it over and over again that our involvement and our improvements and producing off the land helps everything.
Well,
in fact, that's one of the things that Susie Hammond brought out. She went and found a study from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on the very wildlife refuge that was trying to take her ranch. And that, so this was done by the federal government, by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And it showed that there was 14 times there was 14 times more migrating birds landing on private property than on the refuge. And that's what the refuge was designed for. They took it over saying, well, this is a migrating bird area, so therefore we have to protect the land, we have to protect the area. And then what they did is they removed all the land users off of it, and it turned into a big weed patch, and now the birds don't want to land there.
Exactly.
So they're landing on private property.
Well, see, their big argument all along has been that private entities are poor stewards of the land, that they know more about it than the schmoes that have their cattle out there. When in reality, if you weren't good stewards of the land, you wouldn't be able to make a living on it. I mean, you're going to take care of it because that's your livelihood. So,
yeah, why would a logger want to, you know, decimate the forest?
Right.
Exactly.
And, you know, that brings up the whole nother, you know, when you talk about the forest, I mean, what they've done to our forest is just almost, you know,
it's criminal. It's absolutely criminal.
And it's cost us, the taxpayers, billions of dollars. And if they would have just allowed the logging industries to do what they were already previously doing, we would still have healthy forests, and it would have cost the taxpayers nothing, and the housing cost would probably be almost half of what it is right now.
Oh, absolutely. You wouldn't have these super
none
fires.
Of it makes sense.
We live in a heavily, heavily forested area, as you'll find out. And, you know, before I forget, we should say you're going to be in Siskiyou County next week on the 26th. But I don't have the flyer. Do you have the information on that?
I don't.
Okay. We'll get it before the end. But for those people that are actually listening to us on the 20th of May, which is the first time the show will air, it'll probably air again. But the 26th, you'll actually be here speaking up in Siskiyou County. So that's Saturday night on Memorial Day weekend, probably 5:30, 6 o'clock, something like that. I know it's a dinner, and it'll be fun. We'll get you the location and all that jazz. But
come out and support the cause. Because these government entities have to know that people do care. People are watching, and people are pretty much fed up.
And people are smart about this.
Yes,
they are.
That's
the thing.
Yeah.
You can pull it over. Yeah. You can get all your environmental support and all that out of the big cities because they don't know anything about this stuff. But the people who actually live there are pretty sharp to it. Let's take one more quick break, and we're going to come back and finish up the hour with Ammon. And so we'll go wherever you want in the last 15 minutes. We know we got you on a time crunch now. you're listening to We the People. You can find us online at wethepeopleradio.us.
A woman and the kids and the dogs and me. I got a shotgun, a rifle, and a four-wheel drive, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I can plow a field all day long. I can catch catfish from dusk.
Well, I can stand beside ideals I think are right, and I can stand beside the idea to stand and fight. I do believe there's a dream for everyone. This is our country. There's room enough here for science to live, and there's room enough here for religion to forgive.
We should put a caveat on that. There's room enough for science that's actually real.
Real science.
Yeah, real science, not just...
No room for
not just
science.
made up agency science.
There you go.
Okay, so Ammon, where would you like us to finish this off? Because this is, I mean, your story obviously could take hours. Uh-oh. Is he back in the cone of silence?
Uh-oh. Hello?
I'm here.
Oh, there you are. There you are.
I put you on mute, so I apologize.
No, that's okay.
I was listening.
It was extra
cool. So, kind of, I guess, just like to, you know, the best we can, just sum up really what's happening. We have a, you know, federal government who, at least when it comes to these land agencies, it does go beyond that, but that is trying to nationalize our lands and resources here in the West. They're also making a pretty good effort out of it in the East as well. And then you have the extreme environmentalists who literally believe that it is their duty to balance the species, as they say. And they look at humans as just another species who has become more intellectual than the other species. They don't believe in God. They don't believe that man in any way has been given, you know, by our Creator, the intelligence that we have.
Yeah, that whole idea of dominion over the earth and all of its creatures. I guess they skip that part.
Yeah, they
don't believe that. That it's a different doctrine. It's not a Christian doctrine. It's not based upon anything but extreme beliefs. And therefore, they literally look at humans as needing to be, in some cases, eradicated, or anything that benefits humans, they look at needing to get rid of it. And I don't want to sound too extreme myself.
No, it's okay. We've done shows on population control, so we've gone all the way.
Yeah, well, I mean, when you look at some of the things, well, most of the things that they do, it doesn't make sense. Like, you know, like taking out the dams and like destroying farms and ranches and all of these things, you know, and they do it all in the name of the species, you know, for like a spotted middle or a, you know, something, sage hen or something to that effect. And they'll just literally destroy, you know, thousands and thousands of ranches and, you know, the lumber industry, and none of it makes sense until you realize that that's their purpose.
Well, and when you put a little
truly create,
well, when you look at it from when you get a little hindsight built up, things like the spotted owl that destroyed the timber industry up here, now they're finding that their recovery efforts have not been successful. Gosh, why is that?
Yeah, but see, you remember the environmentalists kind of get on the coattails of the. Those, you know, in power for socialism and one world government and that type of stuff. And they work, they work together. And so you end up with a situation where the environmentalists think they're getting what they want, which is to, you know, improve the habitat for the species. And really, the socialist, you know, communist, one world order, government type of individual or people in government, they're using the environmentalists to basically get control of the land.
Yes.
And to socialize it. And, I mean, that's literally what's happening. And so, but the reality of it is our ability to use the land and the resources is becoming extinct. And it's becoming actually dangerous to actually use and extract the resources. And you, people in the city might think, oh, well, of course you can't just cut down a tree. Well, the reality is, or you know, you can't just go to the lumber store and get the tree.
Yeah, right.
I mean, that tree has to be, you know, has to grow, and it has to be harvested, and it has to be milled and transported. I mean, you know, the food doesn't just come from the grocery store, and it doesn't come even from the market.
What?
yeah, and food doesn't come from the grocery store. That's the real kicker in this is, you know, what was it, the Chinese dog food that poisoned everybody's dogs at one point? I mean, if we're not careful and we can't feed our own population, so those people have trouble with grazing or all these different things, usage of water. If we don't have the ability to feed our own people and we're dependent upon foreign countries for food, massive national security issue.
Oh, but Amon's right. It's not just grazing lands. It's logging.
Yeah, it's
mining. It's water. It's all of these natural resources that we have in abundance that can be managed.
Right.
And see, that managed part is where they have the big issue. They think that if we just leave it alone and just let it do its thing, it'll be pristine and...
Yeah, no, it'll burn up and it'll look like the moon.
Catch on fire.
Exactly. Now, the earth is designed for man to use.
Yep.
That's the way it was designed. I mean, you take a house that you're living in, and you live in it and take care of it, and that house can be beautiful for 100 years. But if you stop living in it, if man stops living in it, it only takes a few years, and the thing completely begins to break down and deteriorate.
Fall apart.
It takes man to live in. Same with the forest. Same with the, you know, the land. I mean, it's designed for the benefit and the use of man. That doesn't mean we have to abuse it. That doesn't mean we have to pollute it. That doesn't mean we do not have the responsibility and duty to take care of it. But we are to use that land for the pursuit of happiness. And the more I study the Declaration of Independence, the more I understand that that's what the founders were talking about when they said the pursuit of happiness. That's what this is all about. That's what the Constitution was drafted for. That's what the earth was designed for. That's what the earth was created for the benefit and the happiness and of man. And that is necessary to pursue happiness.
Yeah, well put. And
agreed.
I think with folks like you that have paid the ultimate price that of spending, you know, 2 years in prison over this, you have a lot to say. You got a good perspective. I'm looking forward to...
I was going
to
say you got a 360-degree view of the problem, that's for sure.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing
it. Tell me this about the Hammond issue and all that. Is they're still in jail, right?
Yep, they're still in federal prison in California.
Yeah, I keep calling it jail. It's a prison, I guess. I should use that word.
And they're still there. Dwight's 76, I think, and Stephen's 46 or 45. And, you know, they still have several more years sitting in prison there for doing
nothing. What's going on with their ranch?
Well, fortunately, you know, they had a ranch hand, and they just, but it literally is minimized down to nothing by the time. And just so you know, one of the things that they forced them to sign through the courts after they, you know, convicted them, they forced the Hammonds to sign a first right of refusal over to their ranch.
Oh, man.
So just in case they couldn't maintain it.
Anyway, that is so unjust, and, you know, I have to be careful of not speaking too, you know, passionately about that, because the fact that they're in prison right now and that they're being is such an injustice here in this country, and I honestly don't see how we as a people will not pay the price for that. You cannot allow injustice to go on and not pay a price for that. And it is what's happened to the rural community, what's happening to the land users who own rights to those lands is just detrimental to really all that is American. And that's why I've just tried to do my best to educate people and help them understand what's happening.
Well, you're a good spokesman for all of that, because, you know, you don't go down the rabbit hole and make it unbelievable. I mean, the facts, let's face it, are big enough, I guess.
Yeah, they really are, and I appreciate this show and your effort to, you know, get some truth out there and not relying on the Wikipedia.
It was kind of funny, though, as I started reading, as I started reading, it was like, wow.
Yeah,
I mean, you could be a politician with all the bad stuff that's out there about you. I mean, it's when you read about people in politics, it's almost like they must have a split personality, because over here there's one side and over here it's like, wow, wildly different. Yeah, you have that.
Well, I am married. I've got 6 children. My youngest is 3 years old. My oldest is 15. 3 boys, 3 girls. I live on a little orchard, actually, in Idaho. I do own a fleet management company where I manage and maintain commercial fleets. Done that for 20 years. So that's kind of my, you know, where I'm at. The son of, you know, Clive and Bundy, who had no intention to be popular or or to be known.
Light a fire under rural America?
Yeah, but he also was not willing to
roll over
these people, take his heritage and his livelihood. I mean, he looks at it as it was passed on to him from 5 generations, and he's not going to be the one to, you know, just have it not passed on. I mean, be the weak link, if
you
will.
Yeah, be the guy who let go of the reins.
Yeah, I mean, it's very clear to me that these individuals who are taking what's not theirs, they're just a bunch of thieves.
Yeah.
And so...
Well, and they're all faceless, so good for you guys for being the poster children for all this. We're looking forward to getting to meet you in real life, and you'll be in Yreka on the 26th of May, and I will post that online at wethepeopleradio.us.
Thanks for coming on with us today.
To Ammon Bundy, and we hope you'll catch the archive and pass it on to your friends. Thanks a lot.